I've noticed you around. I find you very attractive.
Thanks. Non-vocal remix.
It would appear.
This is the. We're gonna just wait until she says the thing. There's a point to this. Are doing a fine job of seducing me. This broad, on the other hand, is stuttering her way to nowhere.
Oh God, you're really gonna do this.
How do you get to a breakdown when there hasn't even been a song yet?
I find you very attractive.
Noted earlier.
I find you very attractive.
You said that 3 times already.
Would you go to bed with me?
No, I would not. Maybe.
It's our new podcast.
If you weren't a simp, maybe if you'd get to the point, maybe if you had said that in the first, 10 seconds of hitting on me with music, maybe I'd have been like, all right, babe, let's go. Let's go for it. Let's get down. I'm feeling experimental today.
You want a tussle?
Yeah, I'm feeling experimental today. You come right up and say it to me. Hey, big man.
Are you going to hold your mic that close to your face the whole time?
I might. Right. I'm feeling intimate right now.
I'm turning you down a little so we're not blowing people's ears out.
Fancy club lady just asked me if I would go to bed with her.
Well, that just makes you so special.
Well, you know.
She was on
E. Who can
E.
blame her?
It was the 90s.
Who can blame her? She, you know, look at this. Look at all this. Look what she gets.
Indeed.
If I say yes, look what she gets.
That's true.
Yeah.
Lucky, lucky lady.
Damn right. Linoleum Life is this.
It is this.
I'm the freewheeling Dave White.
You are not the freewheeling Dave White.
That's what my crew calls me.
On any planet in the known universe.
The crew that I run with, they call me the freewheeling Dave White.
Unless, like, they voted that the word freewheeling now means the opposite of what freewheeling has always meant. Show me that piece of paper, because otherwise you are not the freewheeling.
Currently, I embody the spirit of freewheeling. yeah. I'm drinking a different kind of tea.
Whoa.
Today. I'm a different kind of honey in my tea.
Oh man, you are living life to the fullest.
I'm crazy. I'm considering offers from fancy ladies. Anything could happen.
Fake salsa bottom.
I'm totally outside the box today.
Look out,
freewheeling Dave White.
Okay, then. You are with movies.com and KCRW's Unfictional. And I'm Alonzo Duralde.
of therap.com and What the Flick. Why did you select that stupid, stupid song?
Well, I didn't know it was going to take that long to get to the chorus.
I like to hear how indignant you get when it's my week to choose the music.
Mm-hmm.
And you are out of your mind with rage.
My choices may be dopey. Yours are actually assaultive.
No, mine are badass. Yours
are torture.
I don't even have the word.
Mine are just lame, which is a whole other thing.
Which is worse?
Well.
You.
It's
given a choice.
It's what we each...
Do we go with the freewheeling Dave White? Or do we go with... The Alonzo Duralde show of 1967.
It is what we each bring to the show that makes the show the show. As we have learned from your attempts to be the winner.
That song is glaringly non me.
Yes, well, exactly. As am I, which is the whole point. You need someone who's glaringly non you to be.
Explain
with you.
Why you chose it.
Because
you now always have a reason. I don't always have a reason now. I changed my mind about needing to have a reason.
Because exactly.
Whatever, we ran out of cassettes.
Whatever I do is wrong.
We're
going to
run out of cassettes.
So it really doesn't matter. But I like to have a reason. Now that you forced me to have a reason, even though you changed your mind about having a reason, I like having a reason.
I've officially changed my mind.
Fine. Well, I still like having a reason because I'm going with
the previous. We don't need to have this. It doesn't need to be thematic anymore.
I'm going with the previous orders because we're doing a horny teen movie this week. And
do you think horny teens want to hear that song?
Not necessarily, but it's a song about being a horny teen.
No, it's a song about being indecisive. It's a song about being timid.
Yeah, well, you think horny teens aren't timid?
In Project X, none of them are timid.
They're timid at the beginning.
They are stripping off their clothes so quick.
Our heroes are timid, and then they get not timid.
When they get a lot of E in their
gullets. Yeah, well, that does kind of take the timid out of the equation for the most part, yes. Before we get to Project X, though, interesting thing that came up this week that I thought would be worth at least a brief mention.
Yes.
The Alamo Drafthouse is doing a cool thing this summer where they are paying tribute to what they call the greatest summer in the history of summer movies.
Right.
1982.
Yes.
And so on the 30th anniversary of all these movies, they are playing those movies on that very night that is the anniversary.
Yes.
And they are playing... Conan the Barbarian.
Nice.
The Road Warrior.
Nice.
E.T.
Nice.
Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan.
Awesome.
The Thing.
Groovy.
And I don't have the list in front of me, but I think there were six movies.
Okay.
Now,
Last American Virgin.
No.
That was the fall of 82.
That was 83?
That was the fall of 82.
Was it? Okay.
Yeah.
I don't remember that movie in theaters.
But it still counts because that's one of the best teenage movies.
Now, I was looking at that, very strong list. I have no quibbles with any of those movies. They're all terrific. But I got to say, I lean more towards the summer of 84. And I don't know if it's just because that was, not only the summer after I graduated from high school, but also the summer that I worked in a movie theater. It was also the summer you worked in a movie theater. It was the summer of Rhinestone. That's not why I think it's a great movie summer, because that was the summer of Ghostbusters, Gremlins, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, Buckaroo Banzai, Breakin', and Purple Rain. And somebody pointed out 16 Candles, although that opened in April, I think. So,
but it was still the summer.
It was still playing
all summer long. Yeah.
So anyway, I just didn't know. I was wondering what your thoughts were as to which was the groovier movie summer.
I don't have an opinion.
Okay.
I was, technically, I was happier in the summer of 82 than I was in the summer of 84.
Right.
Because
you weren't slinging grape soda.
I wasn't. Well, in the summer of 84, I worked two jobs.
Oh, right.
And I slept 4 hours a night. Imagine that.
Yeah. The kind of thing you can only do when you're that age.
Think of me as I am. No, but I was that way when I was a kid, too. If I didn't get the full 8 hours, even as a young teenager, or a young 20-something,
right.
Even no matter how old I was all day. I've been a baby about getting enough sleep my entire life.
That's not very freewheeling.
It is not. Be that as it may.
Yes.
You don't get to decide what freewheeling means. Well, I have defined it for myself.
I have to live with the Dave White, so I know that freewheeling is not a word that anyone uses.
Give me my freewheeling.
Now, actually, the summer of 82 for me was one of the summers that I got packed off to Spain to, you know, live with the relatives and work on my Espanol. So I actually didn't see a lot of those movies in the theater. Like, I remember I saw E.T. like in August, late in the summer. I missed Tron. That was the other one.
Tron.
Yeah. I missed Tron entirely. Like, it had come and gone already.
I don't think Tron came to our town.
Wow.
I don't remember it coming to our town.
Now, was this Roswell at that point?
This was Hobbs by this point. And I don't remember it coming to our town. I think that it failed box office-wise.
So it didn't even get to the second tier?
Didn't even get to that. Well, we were like third, fourth tier. Oh, gotcha, like little tiny town.
Sure.
You know, you wait. People forget. And sometimes even I forget.
Movies didn't always open on 3,000 screens.
Not only did movies not open on 3,000 screens, but they took months to roll out
right
to the small towns.
Right.
Like you would sit and I would watch Siskel and Ebert on PBS uh-huh. and be like, okay, so they say this movie opens this week, which means we'll get it in 10 weeks maybe.
And this is like big
movies.
Big movies.
Yeah.
Like My Dinner with Andre wasn't coming at all.
You're funny. Boy that grew up in Atlanta, Georgia. Yeah.
Mom, drive me across town to the Repertory Cinema so that I can watch Citizen Kane on a big screen. Do it for me, Mom. I'm 8 years old and I already know what Repertory Cinema is.
Yeah, that's not.
I was 11.
Whatever. Guess what we didn't have.
And you're mean.
Guess what we didn't have in the little
Repertory Cinema.
Guess what we didn't have in the little turd environments that I grew up in. Rep houses,
yes,
or art houses,
yes,
or any kind of houses. Yes. We had.
You had the Jerry Lewis Twin Cinema in Roswell.
In when I was a little kid in New Hampshire, we had two single screeners
mm-hmm.
and one twin cinema.
Yeah.
And then there was a drive-in a ways away.
Mm-hmm.
And then we moved to Roswell, and there was a twin cinema on one end of town, and a twin cinema on the other end of town, and a one screener in the middle,
mm-hmm.
and a drive-in out of town.
Right.
And then in Hobbs, there were two single-screen theaters and a drive-in. That's it.
Gotcha.
Like, when I finally went off to college for the first time, I was ecstatic that I was like, oh, look, a four-screen theater in a mall. Like,
I've arrived.
I've arrived in a bustling metropolis. Lubbock, Texas. Yeah. This is how I grew up. So,
well,
the whole idea of you know, the greatest summer... It hardly means anything to me because in 82 we had like E.T. E.T. Right. was in the theater
all summer long.
And it was there all summer long. And that was it. That was your choice. And then there was another theater.
Gotcha.
And that they had, you know, Horror Hospital. No joke.
Right. That was actually Visiting Hours. Is that the movie?
Visiting Hours. Yeah. I'm sorry. Visiting Hours.
That was the year I was 15. That was the year that I started being able to sneak into R-rated movies on my own. Like I had previously guilted older siblings into taking me to certain things. Like I had read Ordinary People and I had read World According to Garp, so that was enough to get them to take me to see the movies. But starting with Conan the Barbarian was the first R-rated movie I faked my way into. I remember also faking my way into Road Warrior, but I don't think we got that until like the fall for some reason. That's what I'm remembering.
Right.
But who knows? Maybe I just again
anyway,
saw it.
I don't have an opinion on the greatest year.
Okay.
Because
your childhood was miserable. Yes, we know.
No. I'm just saying that No, my childhood wasn't. I mean, it wasn't always miserable.
How bleak was my puberty?
Yeah. I don't believe there is such a thing as a greatest year. I know that everyone's like, oh, 1939, you know, but. And that's great. I mean, every year, if you are expansive enough in your tastes,
sure.
Every year has terrific movies that come out. Some of them, even that will endure long past.
Right,
you know,
but
they might be small and they might be cult, but
1939 is seen as the year, like that's the apex of the Hollywood studio system.
I know, yeah.
You know, and I think they're looking at 1982 as the peak year of Can we please close that window?
Because we cannot close the doors because it's too unseasonably warm here today. Oh, and we're going to deal with crowd noise. And I think that this is kind of a nice thing because
it's like we have an audience.
It's like we have an audience
who won't shut up. People who are not paying attention. Yeah. Yes. Love that. I think what they're saying is that 1982 was the greatest summer movie summer.
Yeah.
You know, which is a specific thing. And I think you can I think you can call out that sort of specificity.
All right, sure.
You know, I for example, again, and this is a subjective thing about where I was and blah blah blah, but like I think of 86 as being like a really great art house year.
That was because of what?
That was a year of like Swimming to Cambodia and Home of the Brave, you know, the Laurie Anderson concert film. And like, I'd have to go back and look, but I remember.
Wasn't it just the year you went to college?
There was just a lot of stuff that I remember being very excited about. So
wrong.
Fine. Whatever.
What I experienced is the thing that everyone needs to adhere to as the standard of the thing.
I prefaced that with, yes, a lot of it is obviously subjective, you know. But you can also look at, you know, I think obviously other factors come into play. Like with 1939, it was before the studios had to give up their theater chains. It was, you know, if you see documentaries, they talk about it. There are several factors come into play as to why that was the sweet spot. You know, it was right before the war. It was, you know, this, that, the other thing. You know, and I who knows for what made 82 such a thing. You know, it was just long enough after Star Wars, Jaws, and Rocky had sort of rewritten all the, you know, concepts of what a summer, that summer movies even existed, much less what went into making them. I don't know. Who knows?
Let's talk about other things.
Okay, we have like a lot
of movies that came out this week.
Oh, we could do that, sure.
What movies came out this week? I'll tell you what movie came out this week.
The Lorax came out this week.
Right, yeah,
The Lorax. And Project X came out this week.
The Lorax and Project X. So, The Lorax is the one about the little furry stump-shaped person.
Yes.
With the mustache.
I think of him as a bean with arms and legs.
Yeah, he's bigger than a bean.
Well, yeah, but he's bean-shaped.
Larger than a bean.
Much larger than a bean, for sure.
Doesn't everyone know what it's about?
I would think that's one of those stories that people grew up on, Dr. Seuss. It's an ecological fable, basically.
Yeah.
The Lorax speaks for the trees.
For the ecology.
Yes. And a thing
that no one says anymore.
Exactly. And he is ignored by the Onceler, who chops down all the truffula trees so that he can make thneeds, which is this, you know, invention that's...
It's a movie you need to see.
I really liked it. And I have to say, like, neither Dr. Seuss nor kids' books in general, I think, have fared particularly well on the big screen. Like, you look at something like The Polar Express, which is this lovely, sweet, compact little story, and then...
And they turn it into a... on screen.
Yeah, this gargantuan... You know, to blow this into three acts is really tricky to do. I mean, like, I'd say the closest that... You know, like Jumanji works because they really kind
Jumanji's
of just...
Jumanji's a blast.
But they use the book as very much as a launching point. Yeah. And, you know, I guess... I'm still back and forth about Where the Wild Things Are. I think you probably like that one more than I did.
I thought it was fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's tricky business to try and take something that compact and, you know... Like, you know, you look at The Grinch. Perfect for a 30-minute TV special. Horrifying as a 105-minute or however long feature film. But I thought The Lorax really worked. I think basically what they do is they treat the story as we know it in the book as kind of the middle.
Yes.
And they create a thing around it where basically, you know, what happens after all the events of The Lorax is that there is this town called Thneedville where everything is made out of plastic and... there are no trees at all, and no one seems to mind except for this one girl named Audrey who wants to see one.
How does she know what they look like? How does she paint them on her house?
That's a good question. That's,
I don't understand
that's
that
never.
All.
I don't know if there's some oral
She's
history
psychic.
Or I don't know. We never find out. I mean, like, obviously they aren't so removed that nobody remembers them because Ted, the teenage kid's, you know, the protagonist's grandmother remembers there being trees, and we see the villain of the piece as a young man. So
Right.
Not that many years have transpired.
Right.
So anyway, this kid Ted is smitten with his older neighbor Audrey, and she wants to see a tree. So he sets out to find one. His grandmother tells him to go out, you know, out of the city and find the Onceler. And
the Onceler tells him the story.
Onceler tells him the story that we know from the book.
The Gon and the Lorax, and he goes away, and there's a trail of tears, and the animals
all leave. Yeah,
they're sad.
And then there's a whole third act, basically.
The fish,
where
are the fish just called fish?
I think so.
And the bears are called. I don't know if they're called anything in the movie, but in the book they're the Barbalutes.
Oh, the Barbalutes. That's right. In their Barbalute suits. Yes, I forgot about that. I haven't read the original story in ages. Again, and it was made into a nice little 30-minute TV special or whatever. And then the end is about, you know, Ted trying to plant the last of the truffula seeds and convince the people of Thneedville that trees are actually a good thing. And despite the fact that you know, the guy who's made a fortune selling everybody air because the air quality is so terrible in Thneedville is trying to stop him.
Yeah.
For me, it worked. I liked the look of the movie. It's from the Despicable Me people. You know, they throw in some songs. It's not a musical per se, but there are a handful of songs and they're all nice.
They're very pointed songs.
Well, yeah, they are about what they're about, really, for sure.
What I really appreciated was how unapologetically, like, Earth First this whole movie is. Like, there is
You can't do this story and not...
It's not timid at all. It's not trying to appeal to everybody. It doesn't
give you an out.
It gives you no out if you disagree. It's like, and if you disagree, basically, it's telling you that if you disagree, you're ignoring facts.
Yeah,
and you are
against science.
You are against science. I mean, they even go so far as to have the villain tell the
Audrey
when she talks about photosynthesis
that it's a made up word.
That photosynthesis is made up and it's a lie. And he even says, "You are lying."
Yeah.
And I loved that moment because that's what's happening in the real world right now,
mm-hmm.
is that people with the facts are being called liars.
By the people with an agenda
by the people with a theology, essentially. And so...
Well, or the oil companies or whoever.
Or the oil companies that have a money-making agenda. Yeah. But I mean, I'm just talking about regular folks who walk around and are like, it's all lies.
Well, it's because they watch Fox News.
I had a lady talk to me about that in my mom's nursing home at my last visit. Because she was, I don't remember now how it came up, but she said something like, so much for global warming, huh? Well, and I was like, well, that's not what that means.
You will recall.
I said, do you understand that's not what that means? And she's like, I don't know. It's like everybody's got a different opinion. I go, well, here's the thing. Because, you know, I was fed up. And I just said, look, I'm not a scientist, but I know enough to know that scientists are smarter than I am. And let's just say for a second that the scientists are wrong. And if the scientists are wrong, then nobody loses. The worst that happens is we have less pollution. So that's still good. And if the scientists are right, and we don't do something about this now, we're all going to die.
Yeah.
And so you decide which one of those options you would like.
I agree with you. That's
and she goes, oh, I hadn't thought about it that way. And I thought to myself, of course you haven't.
Well, you will recall a dear friend of mine for my entire life has reached a certain age and decided now that Al Gore is the prince of lies. You know, and I tried arguing the point with her, and it's like, all right, you are just old now, and this is what you've decided, and, you know, you're going to live in fear because you are conservative now.
Yeah.
Even though you taught me as a child to be open-minded.
Well, I don't understand the whole, I mean, no, we're not talking about the movie anymore, we're talking about jerks, but, like, if you're a conservative, shouldn't you want to conserve things?
Shouldn't you also want to conserve
the planet you live on?
Well,
like, should you also not want to be wasteful and gross and destroying things? Well, like, I don't
the thing
understand.
Is, there is a
make deep, me understand.
There is a deep vein of sort of corporatism of, like, we read Ayn Rand and nobody should tell the tycoons what to do, and they know what's best, and the market will decide, and blah, blah, blah.
Clearly
blah.
They don't know what's best, because they just ruin everything they touch.
Yeah, but they will spend, they make tons of money, because they spend tons of money buying politicians and buying public opinion with, you know, ridiculous propaganda campaigns. And so, yeah, you're right. Ultimately, it boils down to, if all the scientists are wrong, the worst that happens is that we will develop other forms of energy that aren't going to cause as much pollution. We aren't going to be, you know, covering the Gulf of Mexico with oil, you know. And if they're right, you know, we will all not die.
Right. So anyway, here's the thing about this movie. Getting back to the actual topic.
The Lorax.
It is a little bit frenzied.
How so?
The Despicable Me people are great, I think. This sometimes felt like if Ken Russell directed a children's animated feature. Like,
really?
There's so much being thrown at you at the same time. It's almost overwhelming and assaultive at times. But that didn't bother me.
You liked Speed Racer.
Yeah. That didn't bother me. That's what you should expect.
I understand, but I did not perceive that. I don't remember feeling bombarded. I never felt like it was throwing too many things at me.
Yeah.
Like what can you name a moment?
Just in general, the atmosphere of it was sort of like, blah, you know, and I'm fine with that. I'm fine with that.
No, I just really, that wasn't my experience. So I don't even know what you're talking about, but okay.
So I approve of that. And so, I just think that, you know, maybe for some little kids, it might be a little overwhelming. But otherwise, I'm a big fan of this. I thought the songs were okay.
Mm-hmm.
I thought the message was great. Yeah. I liked that they tell you straight up that this is not going to be the book. That the very first thing you get is the Lorax
standing in front of
a curtain saying, "This is not the story you know. It's more."
Yeah.
And I appreciated that without them trying to rework it and pretend like, well, this is the way it's always been.
Right.
In Lorax Town, you know. Yeah. So. While I appreciate the fact that the original book and the original TV special end on a bummer of a note, I do also appreciate the idea of showing how it doesn't have to end in tragedy.
Right, but at the same time, I think accomplishing the same goal of the ending, which is it's up to you to go out there and make a difference.
Yeah,
you know, so I think I think in changing the ending, it doesn't pave over it. You know, it still leaves kids with the same message of it's your responsibility. You are a steward of the planet.
Correct.
Get out there and, you know, do the right thing.
And again, it's the best Dr. Seuss feature that there's been. Horton Hears Who was fine.
Since the 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T.
Since 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T, which is the greatest.
Which is coming up at CineFamily, I think, if we didn't already.
Oh, is it really?
Yeah,
I'll go see that again.
I would see that again.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and then I don't know that and this is a first in film history that the two major films of the week both have titles that end in X.
You've been saying that, you've said that like three times to me this week, and I don't understand why it's a thing to you.
It's just an odd, quirky thing, and I haven't said it in any media yet, so that's why I'm saying it here. Whatever, it's nothing. So, yeah, so Project X also opened this week, and it's a party movie about teens who party, and it is a party movie on steroids. And that, you know, you can't just trash your parents' house now. You have to destroy the entire neighborhood.
Yeah, it's a fantasy.
Yeah,
it's a fantasy for boys. It's a boys' fantasy.
Totally. Yeah.
It might be a fantasy for girls, but I think it's the kind of fantasy for girls that they would never allow themselves to indulge in real life. Like, a boy might want to actually recreate this film.
Oh, but they're gonna.
But a girl would look at this movie maybe and say, well, in a perfect world, I would take off my top and jump into the pool.
Right.
And make out with any boy I felt like it.
Or girl.
Or girl. And then walk away.
Mm-hmm.
Intact. And so,
yeah, and it wouldn't be on a million cell phones.
And it wouldn't be on a million cell phones or on Facebook or Twitter. Yeah. It's definitely a fantasy film. But it's And what I do love about it is how brazenly obnoxious and unlikable everybody in this movie is. Like,
even the lead guy?
Oh yeah.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, he's a first of all, he's a dummy. And secondly, he's easily swayed and
he has wishy-washy,
no
yeah.
spine.
That's true.
And finally thinks what he did is just okay. Like, he's fine.
Well, so does the movie.
And so does the movie. Yeah. And so, like, I appreciate that about the film. I appreciate that.
It is an irresponsible film.
It is an irresponsible film, and I'm glad that it's an irresponsible film. And it fits in with the Todd Phillips, you know, worldview.
Yeah. Including even that documentary that he did that never got released.
Frat House.
Yeah, because they claim he staged parts of it.
Yeah. And
may or may not be true. I've heard differing viewpoints.
Going all the way back to, now he's the producer of this. He's not the director.
Right.
But going all the way back to the first film he made, Hated, mm-hmm. which is a documentary about Gigi Allen, who is maybe the most disgusting human being that was ever a part of punk rock.
Like, and that's saying something.
Seriously, yeah. And like, there are things that happen in this documentary that I don't think I can say out loud on a podcast that is still clean.
Probably not.
And I saw it in a theater. I saw it on a big screen.
Mm-hmm.
And it's gnarly. Like, but it distills everything about what fascinates Todd Phillips as a filmmaker and even as a producer. And it's people who push things way too far, you know, over the cliff.
Mm-hmm.
And
did he do Road Trip also?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Which was not great.
And but an Old School, which I've never seen.
Old School, which is funny. And
Chicken Hawk, right?
What?
Doesn't he have some affiliation with Chicken Hawk?
The documentary?
Yeah.
The NAMBLA documentary?
Yes.
I don't know.
Okay. Can you pull up IMDb? I want to say that he was like a producer or something on that.
I'll pull up IMDb. And find out. I don't know that that's the case. Let me see.
I don't know where that I got that one, but I for some reason remember that being a thing. But yeah, he did the two Hangover movies, obviously, which is his main claim to fame.
Yeah.
And yeah, so I mean, this movie is basically about like teens who throw this out of control party, and despite the fact that like you know they destroy all this property, like otherwise everything's awesome. So I'm sure I can see there being copycats and irate parents.
Oh yeah,
on this one.
This is a horror movie for parents.
Yeah,
this is like I don't see Todd Phillips' name anywhere on this IMDb page.
Okay, then I don't know. I somehow made that up. Never mind. Scratch that.
Allen Ginsberg is in it.
Oh, I'm sure he is
because he was a NAMBLA.
Right, I know. Defender.
Defender. Yeah.
So was Harry Hay. Well,
really,
Harry Hay was a defender of their right to like participate in like pride parades and stuff.
Really?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, I know.
No,
yeah.
No, no. No, dudes.
I am not.
Don't be gross and be in the pride parade.
Yes. We have enough problems.
Don't be raping the children
yes.
and be in the pride parade.
No.
Don't
be raping the children even and not being in the pride parade, for that matter. Just so we're clear on that. I don't know why I thought he had some affiliation with that movie.
Stop
okay.
raping the people.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Breitbart.
What are we talking about?
Project X.
It's getting angry reviews.
Yeah.
People are angry about this.
If
movie.
I were a parent, I would be annoyed. I mean, like, Christy was, you know...
She's got a two-year-old.
Well, still. She's going to have a teenager one of these days.
And that kid's going to party.
Yeah. I did.
He's being raised in Los Angeles.
It's like, I find a lot of this film, there are reprehensible aspects of this film, not just about the partying per se, but about the fact that it is such a white male privilege fantasy where, like, every girl who goes to this high school or who shows up at this party is, like, hot model who whips her top off to jump in the pool. It's insane.
Yeah.
But I did laugh a lot. I am officially super sick and tired of the first-person camera movies. I know the kids are all on YouTube, and they all got the phones mm-hmm. and the whatever.
I'll tell you, I liked how it was shot, tumblers though. And I liked the party scenes. And I liked the sort of hypnotic effect of the party scenes. I liked the...
The you are there
the
quality.
Music the parts that were just showing kids doing party things and the music just screaming in your face, I thought those scenes, those sequences were really, like, cinematic in a cool way.
No, it is skillfully made, but
Do you know how long it took them to shoot that party?
How long?
5 weeks.
Wow.
Yeah. How did they do that? Where did they do that? That had to be on a studio lot somewhere.
I'm sure it's
like
on a
residential lot.
Yeah, on
back
the Warner
lot
Ranch.
Somewhere.
Yeah, no, I'm sure that whole block was like a set they usually use for Desperate Housewives or something.
Yeah, that was... Because I sat there thinking, where did... This is the...
It's not... They did not shoot
real
in a real neighborhood.
Neighborhood.
No, because it's all at night.
Yeah.
For, you know, almost
it's all at night, and it's all... I mean, like, that was a shoot that started at 6 p.m. and wound up the next morning at 6 a.m.
Right.
Like, for 5 weeks.
Yeah.
That's crazy. All I can ever think of when I see stuff like that now is our friends who work on TV shows and movies and how how while I'm asleep at night, they're pulling out their hair and being yelled at by somebody.
Right.
You know, because they haven't gotten the right, you know, they can't get the background to be quiet.
Right. I don't know. I just kind of feel like you really have to have a good reason to do it. I think it is shot well. It does look good, but you could have done that movie not as a first person, and it still would have worked.
I don't know. I think it needed that immediate stuff, because I said in my review that,
or even it could have been told, like, with an objective narrator with occasional inner cuts of
the way it looks.
You know,
feels like that whole Vice magazine aesthetic of like, hey, look at my wasted friends, you know.
Look at these trashy girls making out.
Sort of pioneered, you know, by these art photographers, people like Larry Clark and Ryan McGinley and Templeton Ed Templeton and another name that I'm wanting to throw out here. But
teens kissing and teens smoking.
Yeah, teenage smokers and stuff like that. That whole sort of school of photography that's like this very immediate Polaroid-y, kids are being irresponsible sort of subject matter. And I thought it looked great. I thought it had this super defiant energy, and I was into it.
I was entertained. I had a good time watching it, but there were things about it that stuck in my craw, mainly...
It's wrong.
I mean, not just sort of the willful...
At the same time.
Not just the kind of willful destruction of property or whatever, but the fact that it was so weighted towards, like, you had these nerdy guys... And, you know, you had a whole mix of guys, you know, nerdy and, like, jockey and whatever else. But, like, with basically all the girls were either, like, hot model types or zaftig African-American girls who could booty pop. That was it. That is it.
Right,
that is the
right.
mix of women in this movie. And so that that annoyed me, frankly. But,
yeah.
But yeah, so, I mean, it's a weird movie to recommend. You have to kind of know what you're in for, but I did have a good time. I can't fault it that, you know. I laughed, I was entertained. Being Flynn, which we disagree on.
I understand what you're saying about Being Flynn. First, so tell them what it's about.
Okay, it's based on the memoir Another BS Night in Suck City. By Nick Flynn.
Yeah,
and
it's a memoir.
It's a memoir, and it's about Mr. Flynn and his father Jonathan, who fancies himself a writer and is massively delusional. Nick Flynn is played by Paul Dano, and Jonathan Flynn is played by Robert De Niro, and Jonathan abandoned the family when Nick was a kid, so Nick was raised by a single mom who's played by Julianne Moore. And as an adult, they have one random encounter when Jonathan gets kicked out of his apartment. He asks Nick for some help in putting things into storage. The next time they cross paths, Nick is working in a homeless shelter, and Jonathan is checking in to the homeless shelter.
Right.
And so, you know, it's about their relationship and their sort of history of you know, the father being neglectful and about where the father is now. Both of them trying to be writers, both of them having substance abuse issues and, you know, not being the best relationship people either.
Right.
And it's written and directed by Paul Weitz, who I heard interviewed on NPR this morning.
Right.
Who has a history of doing interesting films about father-son relationships or sort of surrogate father-son relationships, particularly in About a Boy and In Good Company. This movie did not work for me, mainly because Robert De Niro's performance did not work for me.
Right.
To me, it felt too big, too much. Yes, he's playing a person who's semi-nuts.
He's mentally ill.
You know,
he's not semi-nuts. He's nuts.
Well, he's but he's functioning.
Somewhat.
He's pretty high functioning.
Okay. If you say so.
Because when we first see him in the film, he is a taxi driver.
Right. Which is, I understand. I know.
He has his own
place.
That's
only for a moment, though.
He's a taxi driver for the first third of the film.
No. That doesn't last very long.
He drives a lot. He does a lot of cab driving. Okay. Enough for you to go, oh my God, I can't believe the movie cast Robert De Niro as a guy who drives a cab. So that really was the thing that bugged me. And then Paul Dano, it's like, there's a really fine
line. Dano or Dano?
I don't really know.
Yeah.
There's a fine line between playing a character who is sort of inert and introverted and, you know, whatever, and just giving a performance that there's no substance to. I think there's a way you can play a character like that and still do rich work. And to me, he just disappears, especially in De Niro's presence, because De Niro is sucking up all the oxygen and eating up all the scenery. So the two of them didn't work for me, and the movie is about them. So that was a big problem that I had with it. I thought everything else was really interesting. I thought all the stuff at the homeless shelter, the milieu, the other people that worked there.
Milieu.
I liked all of that stuff. I thought it was really compelling. I loved Julianne Moore's performance and flashback as the mom.
Yeah.
I liked Olivia Thirlby. I liked a lot of the supporting characters. De Niro was driving up the wall, and his performance just felt so... Nobody was holding him in check. Paul White's, I guess it bears noting, also directed Little Fockers.
Did he really?
Yes.
Oh, man.
The joke that I made in my review was like, if you did a Garfield without Garfield and did a Being Flynn without the Flynns and took out the two lead characters, you got a movie. But as is...
I agree with you that Robert De Niro's performance was big, but I didn't find it... out of control big.
Okay.
I thought that the character being delusional and a loudmouth, I felt like that was basically what you had to, he had to be that guy. And I think within that context, he did it right. Especially given the fact that I can't remember the last time I saw a movie with Robert De Niro where it didn't feel like he was just half grumblingly feeling like obligated to be there.
To have shown up at all. Yeah.
Like it feels like he's acting like he's doing everyone a favor half the time.
Well, yeah.
When he shows up in movies now.
He gives his all, but I think his all may have been too much.
I'm gonna move on from that. I understand that the movie was pushy as well. Like, I feel like there was not a moment when I wasn't being told what I was supposed to think. But much like War Horse, I found it moving. Mm. And maybe that's just my own personal stuff. You know, the whole father-son reunion kind of thing. I tend to, movies like that tend to get me.
No, I get it.
I think it's why guys like Field of Dreams, you know.
Oh, totally, yeah.
Which is not a great movie at all, really.
It's effective.
But it's totally effective. And so this affected me. And so okay. I found it very sad and very moving.
I find it really difficult when people make movies about writers.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because the act of writing, I think, is so inherently non-cinematic.
Well, yeah.
You know, and so it's like, so it's either...
Well, unless I'm doing it.
Yeah. So it's either like... It's
provocative.
It's either somebody's at the typewriter or scribbling away at a pad, or they're running into a bar with a sheaf of papers in their hands. I mean, like, I've got the manuscript. Yeah, there's a limited number of things you can do. And then worse, this movie has dueling... narrators.
Yes.
Two would-be writers narrating this
Both
movie.
Both of them unreliable.
In their would-be writer style.
One of them crazy, the other one, you know, a young, aimless.
And it's just...
Drug addict.
Yes, yes. And Paul Dano, who already tends to look like a drowned rat anyway, like
he does.
Then oh, and now you're gonna smoke crack. Great. I want to see that.
He does look like a drowned rat.
He totally looks like a drowned rat.
Remember when he was a little kid in that movie L.I.E. and yes. he was kind of chubby.
I guess he remember was. Remember being yeah, a little
chubby
yeah, yeah.
in that movie, and then like he got all tall and grew up and now
gangly.
Now he looks gangly all the time.
You know, maybe it's that I don't like Paul Dano in New York. You know, because I love him in like Little Miss Sunshine and then
There Will Be Blood,
but this is the second movie I've seen him in New York, and it's the second movie that I couldn't stand. Remember The Extra Man?
What was that?
That one with Kevin Kline, where like...
Oh, God.
That unbearable
that
movie.
That was unbearable, yeah.
Which I should have... You know, it was written by... It's like based on a Jonathan Ames thing. It's directed by Sherry Springer Berman yeah, and
Jonathan
Robert Pulcini,
Ames,
who
John
did...
Jonathan Ames is great.
Yeah, and it's directed by yeah. the people who did American Splendor,
yeah,
which
you
is
would
one
think
of my
it
favorite...
You would think it would have been awesome.
Yeah, boy, did that not work. Yeah. And so, yeah. Anyway, so being Flynn, Dave liked it more than I did. There are things about it that I liked. It is up to you to see what you think about De Niro's performance.
Tim and Eric's billion-dollar movie.
Oh, that's this week, too.
Tim and Eric's billion-dollar movie.
Okay, speaking of subjectivity.
Tim and Eric's billion-dollar movie.
Why don't you explain
Tim and Eric's billion-dollar movie.
You explain it.
Tim and Eric's billion-dollar movie.
You are pretty much nailing what I don't
Tim
like
Eric's
about Tim and Eric.
Movie.
Which is that they think
Tim
it's
and Eric's
funny
billion-dollar movie.
To just do things over and over again or generally make you annoyed or uncomfortable.
They are the greatest. And this is already one of my favorite movies of the year.
Oof.
It is absolutely stupid and confusing and
I will agree with you that if it is true enough to their established aesthetic.
I love everything about what they do. They did the same thing they always do. Only now it's in a movie.
If you're a fan of Tim and Eric, if you know them from Tim and Eric Awesome Show, Great Job from Adult Swim, or from Tom Goes to the Mayor, and you like what they do, you will like what they do here.
It is full of mucus and diarrhea.
If, like me, you sometimes find them funny and generally find them annoying, you will find this movie occasionally funny and mostly annoying.
It is occasionally good and mostly awesome.
So if you are trying to figure out whether or not you want to see this movie,
it is always great.
TiVo an episode of Awesome Show, Great Job.
Everything in this film is perfect.
And then see how that works for you. Because it really boils down to this. If, like Dave White, you think these clowns are funny, then you'll have a great time at this movie. This movie was made for you.
They are the funniest people.
If you find them irritating, you will not be won over by this movie because they don't do anything different.
I'm going to go see it again.
Great.
I'm gonna
have
take
fun.
Aaron and I are going to go see it again.
Great.
It's about them going to a mall and saving a dying mall.
It reminded me of UHF. In that they play...
That's okay.
They play sort of doofuses who wind up with this thing that they have to turn around, and the thing is sort of a license to do sort of goofy sketch comedy and introduce weird characters. In this case, yeah, they blow $1 billion making a terrible movie. The Schlang Corporation comes after them for to get their money back, and they fall for a TV pitch from this insane person who says that if you take
Will Ferrell,
played by Will Ferrell, says come take over my mall and make $1 billion, and they come to this mall which has like a used toilet paper store and open fires and a wolf marauding around the food court.
And a boy who lives in the walls named Taquito.
Yes, who was abandoned years ago by his parents and who is now played by John C. Reilly with a constant running nose.
There's a sex scene in this movie with a 65-year-old woman and Tim Heidecker that is intercut with scenes of Eric Wareheim being diarrheaed on by four young boys.
And there you have it.
And that is the.
Do
is the
you
greatest,
want to see this?
That is the greatest.
Then this is the movie
part
for you.
Of this entire film.
Are you gagging at the thought of
and
seeing
it
this?
It is the best.
Do not go see
the best
Tim
movie.
And Eric's Billion Dollar Movie.
It is the best movie. What I love most about it is that my review on movies.com was a 5 star out of 5, and Grace was half of 1 star.
which is well, how it should be.
We always. She and I frequently agree.
No, but I think there is no middle ground on this movie. You are either on board
or you are watching in horror. And I mostly watched in horror. I laughed some, but it was mostly...
Now, didn't you see it at Sundance?
I saw it at Sundance.
So there was all kind of walkouts
at the premiere
screening, wasn't there?
That's what there were some. I wasn't really paying attention. But, you know, it is just one of those things where you either like it or you don't. And I don't particularly like it. I think they have a very limited bag of tricks. And I think that they... I feel like it's like yes, okay, I get it, and then it keeps going and it keeps going and keeps going. It's like, no, I really get it. You can stop now. So yeah, that's what it boils down to for me.
Dobus.
And then you saw a couple movies this week that I did not.
I don't know what those are.
You saw the Snowtown Murders and you saw the Snowtown Murders.
The Snowtown Murders is an Australian film that in Australia, I believe, and Europe is just called Snowtown.
I believe you're right.
And they call it Snowtown Murders here. Because
it sounded like a Christmas special.
America loves murder, and they didn't want people to think it was a Christmas
movie. Wait, does it even snow in Australia?
I don't know.
Aren't they too close to the equator for that sort of thing?
Australian listeners, please tell us if it ever snows.
Yeah, because I know we have a few in Australia. So tell us.
And
I know if it does snow, it snows in July, but, you know.
It's a bummer of a movie because it's set in a super poor neighborhood, and it's about these guys who go on a vigilante killing spree. It's a true story. It really happened.
Cocaine? Is that why they call it Snowtown?
No, the name of the town is Snowtown.
Right, but... Oh, Snowtown, it's actually Snowtown.
Okay. Snowtown, Australia.
Okay,
it's so a place.
It's not slangy or something.
No, gotcha. It's a place.
Okay.
And...
Is it like Animal Kingdom, this movie?
Yes. Only more depressing and more and more grimy, and the people are more... Like, it's all non-professional actors, except for one, the main guy, who's the serial killer. And I tell you, I made me want to read the book, because I didn't understand about 50% of the things that came out of people's mouths while I watched it. The accents are so impenetrable that... And half of the scenes take place around the dining room table. People are eating.
Oh, great.
People are eating and going... And I'm like, can I have some... Subtitles. I mean, Lynn Ramsey did that for Ratcatcher. It was an English language film with subtitles.
There was a
Bloody
was a
Sunday.
Ken Loach.
It was an Irish movie. Lady Bird, right?
No, Lady Bird wasn't, but it was Riff Raff?
Riff Raff had subtitles. Riff Raff, yeah. English language films from parts of the world where English is spoken, but with really, really, really
regional
dialects. They need subtitles. They just need subtitles.
Right.
And I don't think that's being like, I mean, I see a lot of films.
You're not being an ugly American.
A lot of places,
here, yeah.
Like, I even pride myself at being able to understand a lot of British slang because I had a crash course of immersion when I was there for 5.5 months.
Right.
And I just learned to listen, you know, pattern my listening to the rhythms of the way people spoke. But. It is.
No, there's a kind of working class Australian that's hard. Like Starstruck is one of my favorite movies of all time.
That's a tough one too. Sometimes.
But I had to see that movie a good 20 times before I understood certain lines of dialogue.
Right.
Because it's like, wait, what?
Yeah, because people just mumble things, and then not only are they mumbling, but they've got this, you know, dialect, and they're using some slang word.
Yeah.
And then you're lost.
Yeah, it's like when we rented Neil Jordan's The Butcher Boy, we had to put the subtitles on because the Irish brogues were so thick. So.
Right.
So yeah, so maybe Snowtown Murders, people might want to wait for DVD then and watch it with the subtitles on.
Yeah, wait for DVD and watch it with subtitles on.
But they should see it, though.
It's atmospheric.
Okay.
It's not badly made.
Okay.
It's, you know, compelling.
Competent, raves Dave White.
You don't learn much about characters or incidents because it's so pulled back and so intentionally sort of naturalistic.
Is it one of the things that's based on a true story that everybody in Australia already knows, but we don't?
Yeah, the most notorious serial killer in Australia.
So there's a lot of stuff that they didn't need explained to them, but we might. I see, gotcha.
Okay.
Tell us about the Touring Horse, Dave.
Oh, it's so perfect.
Your first Bélatar film, correct?
Magnificent. This movie is the last Bélatar movie.
Well, he says.
And
they always say
says,
that.
Yeah. It's very much in keeping with the way he makes films. He extremely long takes that last, you know, 5, 8, 10, 12, 15 minutes. which is unheard of in most filmmaking, you know. But black and white, 2.5 hours, very little dialogue, and tons of heavy sort of pessimism and symbolism and all the other isms. And
I watched a few bits when you were watching it, the screener.
It's magnificent. It's beautiful.
Is it in black and white, or yes, is it just in drearo color?
It's in black and white, and it's a very sort of silvery black and white.
Yeah.
That you can't stop looking at, even though the scenario is sort of ugly.
Right.
These peasants living in the middle of a windstorm.
Yeah.
In a valley where they are alone, and in a stone hut. The movie begins with a black screen voiceover by Bélatar narrating, talking about the story of Friedrich Nietzsche throwing his arms around a horse that is being beaten and then going mad afterwards. And what, when they say going mad, what they really mean is that he,
had the vapors,
dementia. Oh. He succumbed to dementia over the course of the next 10 years. And then the very next thing you see is a horse, which may be the horse. They don't tell you.
The horse that Nietzsche.
The horse. Raised? Yeah.
Okay.
Maybe that's the horse. And maybe this is the guy that was beating the horse. But they're not in Turin. They're in somewhere, but it's not Turin, and they're speaking Hungarian.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe it's the horse, maybe it's not the horse, maybe it's like the spirit of the horse. We don't really know. But what you do realize is that over the course of the film, something bad happened before the first shot that you see of the horse.
Mm-hmm.
Because the horse stops functioning for the family. The family is an old man, cab driver. Coach driver, mm-hmm, and his adult daughter, and they live a brutal subsistence rural life of barely any talking, eating one potato a day, and sitting in silence looking out the window as the windstorm doesn't let up. I mean, the entire film, 2.5 hours, is like this whole noisy storm that gets worse instead of better. And bit by bit, everything breaks down. A drunken neighbor comes by and declares that humanity has debased itself beyond recognition and that things are going to stop soon. A band of gypsies come by, and they seem pretty merry, but they also seem sort of marauding. Mm. And they want some water from the well, but the daughter drives them away, and she's like, get away, go, leave us alone. And as they roll off, they yell back to her, the water is ours, the earth is ours, drop dead. And the next day the well goes dry.
Yeah.
So something's happening, like either Nietzsche, you know, caused some sort of sins of mankind thing to roll into place, or the gypsies cursed them, or God's just fed up with everything, or there is no God, and because you killed him, that's what Nietzsche says.
I was gonna say.
You know, Nietzsche says God is dead and you killed him. Either way, the world's coming to an end. It is Genesis creation story, but backwards. Mm. It's and then I'm not gonna give away the ending, but it ain't happy.
I'm guessing it doesn't involve a musical number.
But I tell you, it's gorgeous. And punishing and heavy and not a casual movie.
Now,
but you really need to see it. I want to go see it at the Music Hall. It's now on a big, it's on a mm-hmm screen here at the Music Hall because they sent me a DVD and I watched it on TV.
Right.
But I want to go to the Music Hall and see it. Like, I want to be on the front row watching this.
We should explain for listeners who do not know who Bélatar is. He is
Hungarian filmmaker, extremely severe. Like,
if you saw Gus Van Sant's Jerry, where Matt Damon and Casey Affleck are lost in the desert, like that movie apparently is very Tar influenced.
Like, very, again, very long takes, very sort of dark natured films about chaos and trouble and punishment and Doom, essentially.
Right.
Doom! And, yeah, so obviously he's great. And if you have never seen a movie like this, don't you want to try one? This is the thing. It's, to me, a movie like this is like a new food that maybe you've never tried before.
Maybe you're a little scared of it.
Maybe you're a little scared to put it in your mouth. But it isn't going to hurt you, you know. And so give it a shot. You know, maybe you will like extremely long, hypnotic, slow movies where people look at potatoes.
Because
I do.
I have to say, the right movie will kind of pull me into its orbit. And yeah. And because generally speaking, on paper, you describe that and I go, ew, I don't want to see that.
Right.
But if I see a movie like that that's done really well, I will, my brain goes to a place where I go with it. And I experience the movie as it unfolds, you know, and I find it really fascinating.
Let's go to the music hall. I'll see it again. Yeah,
I'll try and see it. Now, the movie that neither of us have seen that I want to see before that is Jafar Panahi's This Is Not a Film,
and yeah, that also is at the music hall right now.
Yes, which I want to. Yeah,
I need to review it really because there was no screening that I heard of before the film.
So hope maybe if we get a chance to see it this week, we will talk about it next week.
Yeah.
Did you want to read? We got a letter about our discussion last week about how awful everyone else in the world is who buys a ticket to things.
Let's hold off on that because we need to wrap this up.
Okay. Do you have a DVD pick?
I have a Netflix streaming pick.
Okay.
Yeah, we'll get to all the mail next week.
Okay. We got some good letters.
People are coming over. We got to start cooking food.
Okay.
Rock and Roll High School is on Netflix streaming now.
Oh, okay.
They just added it.
And DVD.
So you gotta see. If you've never seen Rock and Roll High School, you gotta see Rock and Roll High School.
It is a great teen movie.
It's got the Ramones. It is an amazing, one of the best teen movies.
Yes.
And it's got all the dead Ramones in it. And where else are you gonna see the dead Ramones except on YouTube clips of the dead Ramones? The Ramones were so awesome. And this was their movie, and they act just like they do in real life.
I actually have two. One is the Criterion Collection just put out Vanya on 42nd Street, which is Louis Malle's, it's not his last film, one of his last films, and it reunites him with his collaborators on My Dinner with Andre. Wallace Shawn, who appears in the film, and Andre Gregory, who did the adaptation of the Chekhov play, Uncle Vanya. It is the film that made me really appreciate Julianne Moore, who we're talking about this week, who's in Being Flynn.
Right.
She gives one of those performances where, you know, like on, if you watch America's Next Top Model, you may have heard Tyra Banks tell models they need to provide their own wind. They need to like make themselves look windswept, even though there is no source of air.
Provide your own wind
coming at them. Julianne Moore in Vanya on 42nd Street provides her own light. She is she is luminous.
You're a little exaggerating.
I just know what
did that to her?
The lighting guy. In any event, she is extraordinary in this movie. This was the movie that made me go, oh yes, her, she's amazing. And then not long after that, she was the star of Todd Haynes' Safe. Anyway,
the best film of the 90s.
Yes, but Vanya on 42nd Street, it's also brilliant in that it does. I don't want to give away how the whole thing starts, but the beginning of it is brilliant. It is a great pared down staging of Vanya. I mean, like, to like our town levels of like minimal sort of, you know, costume, prop, whatever, but so compelling, so well acted. Larry Pine is in it, and I'm forgetting her name. The actress, she plays the woman who gets kidnapped in Silence of the Lambs. Brooke Smith.
Yeah.
Wallace Shawn. It is so, so great. If you've never seen Vanya on 42nd Street, now there's this great Criterion Collection. Check it out. The other one I wanted to recommend is Head.
Oh, yeah.
In honor of Davy Jones, who passed away this week. They did show it on Antenna TV, if you get that where you live. But it is part of the BBS box that Criterion put out a year or two ago. And it's also, I think, available on its own. Like, I think Rhino put it out a few years back on DVD. But it is a great, plotless, hilarious film with terrific Monkees songs. It was written by Jack Nicholson. It's Bob Rafelson's first film right before he and Nicholson teamed up again to do Five Easy Pieces. It is on its own merits, I think, a very fun kind of weird stream of consciousness movie. But if you go to the Wikipedia page, and I wouldn't do this till after you've seen the movie.
Yeah.
Their plot description of it actually...
Whoever wrote it, yeah.
It does make a lot of sense, and they actually interpret it in a way that almost makes it like the live-action feature-length Duck Amuck. The Chuck Jones Daffy Duck cartoon, you know.
That's pretty funny.
Which questions the idea of, like, you know, how much free will do any of us have, much less people who are appearing in a movie? So anyway, check it out. I recommend it. And we thank you for listening. As always, you can drop us a line with any questions or comments at linoleumcast@gmail.com. You can go to on Facebook and like our Linoleum Knife podcast page. Mm-hmm. Follow us at Twitter at linoleumcast. Yeah. You can also follow me at A. Duraldi. You can follow Dave at D. Leland White.
On Twitter?
On Twitter.
I'm a real bad Twitterer. If you follow me on Twitter, I mean, you should obviously follow me naturally on Twitter.
But don't expect a lot.
But don't expect tons of twittings from me because I don't have a smartphone. I get on my laptop when I remember to do it. It's like every 3 days I'll remember to put something up there.
I tweet with some frequency.
You should really just friend me on Facebook because I'll friend you right back.
Okay.
You don't have to be timid about it. You just be like, just click, send a friend request on Facebook.
How do they find you? Because there's a million Dave Whites.
Well, you go to movies.com.
Oh, and they have a link.
Click on my face on the page on movies.com. And then that'll give you a list of all the things I've reviewed for the past 5 years.
And then click on any review.
There's in my little bio.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
On that page, that's just my page. Mm-hmm. There's a link to my Twitter and a link to my Facebook.
Okay,
so you can just I mean, I'm D. Leland White.
Gotcha.
On Facebook.
Gotcha.
Because there's 5 million Dave Whites in the world, but that's how you do it.
I want to recommend our friends in the podcast world. I can't remember if we mentioned this. We were on Steve Gelder's very entertaining show, Independent Thinking, on New Dissident Radio a few weeks ago. So if you missed it, look in their archives. You should be able to find us. Also, of course, want to thank Popcorn Mafia, The Comedy Couch with Dennis Hensley and Tony Tripoli, Blowhard, Fat Guys of the Movies, The Criterion Cast, The Showbiz Sandbox, Secretly Timid, Throwing Shade, Team Jack, Schmoes Know. And if you're a fan of this show, and we certainly hope you are, do us a favor if you haven't already. Go to iTunes and leave us a nice review. The more good reviews we
nice
get...
Nice review.
Favorable.
A nice review.
Yes. Yeah. The more of those we get, the more people can find the show. And, of course, you can also check
especially if you mention me.
You can check into the show on getglue.com.
We're listed
as a TV show, but, you know, it doesn't matter. It still works. I don't know that we're ever going to get switched over. Like, it took them 2 weeks to acknowledge the fact that Melissa Harris-Perry had a show on MSNBC.com, and that was with lots of people complaining. So, heaven knows. Anyway, we thank you for listening, as always, and we will catch you next time.
Bye.